And on the line, I have the man who knows all about what's up there. That's Dr. Martin George, the astronomer, his official title, Principal Astronomer at the Hyde Planetarium. How are you this morning, sir?
Hi, Brian. I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Fit for yakking all day. I'm going to talk. Now, you've sent me a couple of items. Artemis, that was an interesting trip, except for the loo.
It was. It was fantastic, actually. It went so well. And this, of course, was Artemis 2. There'd already been an uncrewed spacecraft called Artemis 1, which you probably would have guessed. But this particular one had four astronauts on board, three from the United States and one from Canada, and they were sent to the moon and back. Now, this was not a landing mission. There's been a bit of confusion as to whether they were supposed to land or not. No, they never were. The whole idea was to go out there on a figure eight path, what we call a free return trajectory, swing around behind the moon, not even going into orbit around the moon, and then coming back to the Earth. And it was a 10-day mission that went pretty well. They were able to test a lot of the spacecraft's facilities, radiation shielding, various other things like that, communication. They did have a famous problem with the toilet, which was a bit unfortunate because, as one or more of the astronauts have said, the toilet's the most important thing aboard the spacecraft. But that was a bit unfortunate. They're going to have to do a bit of redesign work there, I think, and the problem was extracting all of the waste products back out into space. That was where the toilet went wrong. But anyway, don't want to talk too much about toilets this morning. It was a fantastic mission, and it is paving the way, Brian, for footsteps on the moon probably by 2028. So we're getting closer and closer. Not long ago, though, NASA has said that Artemis 3, which was going to be a lunar landing mission, probably in 27 or 28, is now going to be an Earth orbital mission to test the components out for one final time in Earth orbit before they send Artemis 4 to the moon in 2028 to land people to walk across its surface. And I think that's a good decision. It takes me back to the days of Apollo 9, which is largely forgotten, actually, because people think about Apollo 11 with Armstrong and Aldrin and so on. But Apollo 9, two missions before that, was a test in Earth orbit of all the components. And that was an essential mission and a very, very important one. So Artemis 3 is going to be something like that. But yeah, great success, that mission. They even saw parts of the moon with the human eye that no human eye had ever laid eyes on before, around the far side of the moon. Spacecraft have imaged it. When the Apollo missions were in progress in the late 60s, early 70s, and there was that famous one lone astronaut going round and round the moon, waiting for the others to come back up. He, of course, went round and round the moon several times, and you might think the astronauts on board Apollo's got a good view of the far side of the moon. The problem is that for a lot of the time that they were going around the moon, much of the far side was in darkness, and so there are parts that hadn't been seen by human eyes, and the four Artemis astronauts recently saw subtle colours on the surface of the moon, which can give more clues as to the composition of that surface. So all in all, fantastic mission. Can't wait for Artemis 3, that Earth orbiting test, and I can't wait for those footsteps on the moon, hopefully in 2028.
It's amazing. You get mind blown away, you know, which watch all these science fiction shows, but a lot of it is, well, it's coming true, which is great. I love it.
It is, and of course it's been a long time. We've had a long wait. It was December 1972 that the last people were anywhere near the moon. So yes. That was Apollo 17. That was a landing mission, of course. But yeah, over 53 years we've been waiting. I thought it'd be just a few before we went to Mars, way back in the 70s and 80s.
But well, it would have had to train a whole new generation of people back here on Earth to actually manage and operate all the systems, I suppose.
Well, that's right. It's been so long that it's almost like doing it afresh for the first time.
Well, let's move on. Voyager switching off some power.
Yes. Now, there are two very famous, well, there's more than two very famous spacecraft, of course, but Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are two of the most famous of all. They were launched in 1977. Voyager 1 went past Jupiter and Saturn. Voyager 2, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And they're never going to come back. They're leaving the solar system forever. So they're going out at great speed. Voyager 1, for example, is heading at 17 kilometres a second away from the sun. So in the period when we've been talking, it's gone hundreds of kilometres. It's really quite amazing. But Voyager 1's been in the news recently because one more of its instruments has been switched off to conserve power. Now, it's happened on Voyager 2 as well. Voyager 2 still has three instruments out of its original 10 operating. Voyager 1 is now down to two instruments, and this is because the power is steadily dropping. It's not unexpected, actually, because they rely on a plutonium power source in what we call a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, and plutonium is decaying. Plutonium uranium-239. That's the power source which generates heat that's then converted into electricity. So they've got about half of the power left that they had when they left, when it left Earth in 1977. And so the instrument that's recently been switched off is called the Low Energy Charged Particle Experiment, which detected particles such as electrons and cosmic rays. By the way, cosmic rays are not rays at all, but they're also particles. It's unfortunate to have to switch that one off, but we've had a lot of data about magnetism, about planetary atmospheres come back from the Voyagers. So gradually those instruments that have provided so much detail are being switched off out of necessity. But there's still two running. The ones on Voyager 1, Cosmic Rays subsystem, is actually still running, I understand, on Voyager 2. But there's a couple that are still working on Voyager 1, and one of those is the magnetometer to measure the magnetic field out there, way out, a long, long way from the sun. And when I say long, long way from the sun, later this year, Voyager 1 is going to reach a point where it's one light day away from us. Now, you've heard the term light year, I'm sure, and I'm sure all of our listeners have. That's a very, very long way. A light day is much less, but it's still about 25 billion kilometers. That's 25,000 million kilometers. So if you can imagine a radio broadcast coming from Voyager to Earth to give some data about the magnetic field and so on, it takes nearly a whole day traveling at 300,000 kilometers every second to get to us. And so if they want to send an instruction up to make some measurement, it takes nearly a whole day for the instruction to reach Voyager and another day to get a response saying, okay, thanks, I got that. And the distances are absolutely amazing. And yet Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are only a tiny, tiny fraction of the distance to the nearest star out of hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy. And Brian, I hope by saying that I've made you feel very small.
I'm still trying to wrap my mind around it. It's just unreal how long it would take to get back.
It is, yeah. Just, when people went to the moon and they were talking to Mission Control in Houston, it took about 1.3 seconds for the radio signal to get back. The moon's really relatively close, only about 400,000 kilometers away. But now and again, in the radio transmissions between Mission Control and people like Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, you hear Mission Control say something and it's getting on for 3 seconds before there's any kind of response at all.
Yeah.
And that's what we expect with the light travel time to the moon and back. Yeah, so Voyager 1, it's still working, heading away at 17 kilometers a second. Voyager 2 is not quite as far away, but they've both passed the edge of the sun's influence in terms of the stream of particles coming from the sun. And you can actually say they are truly in interstellar space. It's an amazing achievement. And more amazing, they were launched in 1977 and they're still working.
It's just about to say that the generations that have been involved in developing that technology, like we said back in the 60s when the moon landing, and then now that there's another, it amazes me that people have to constantly keep learning from the previous experiences. And after watching The Dish and seeing the guy trying to do calculations on a slide rule, I can relate to
that. Yeah, previous experiences are very, very important. There's no space mission really where it's 100% perfect. There's some little glitch or something like that, but you learn from them all and you learn how to do things a bit better next time. So, yeah, it's amazing what we're doing. But, yeah, if I'd bought some appliance in 1977, it probably would have failed by 1978 or 79, just past the guarantee period.
Yeah, as usual.
Yeah, with Voyagers, they were so beautifully built, just a real testament to the work that people put into them.
We will be back with Dr. Martin George straight after this musical break. And now it's returned to the talk to the astronomer at the Hive, Dr. Martin George. Talking about latest things, how about current night sky? What do we expect to see?
Okay, well, if you go out in the early evening, in the very early twilight, looking low in the northwest, Venus is back. Now, Venus, of course, is a very famous planet. It's the brightest of all. Very low down in the twilight at the moment, though, so it's not looking as brilliant as it can and as it will in the weeks and months to come. But going out around 6 o'clock, 6:15 in the evening at the moment, and you'll catch a great view of Venus low down near the horizon. Above and to the right of Venus is Jupiter, and those two, as the weeks go by now, will appear to gradually get closer and closer together because of their motion around the sun combined with ours, and we see them sort of looking at different angles. But up above Venus, up above and to the left of Jupiter, that famous constellation of Orion the Hunter, with the three stars in a row forming his belt, probably one of the most recognizable of all constellations. Of course, he's upside down for us because we're standing upside down compared to people in the Northern Hemisphere who named him. But if you're looking for the Southern Cross, it's quite high up now in the evenings in our southern sky. Tipped up a little bit over to the left in the early evening, but very easy to recognise, and those two stars called the Pointers, not very far away. By the way, those two stars called the Pointers, which currently appear below and to the left of the Cross in the evening, they're called Alpha Centauri and Beta Centauri. That indicates, because of the first two letters of the Greek alphabet being Alpha and Beta, that they're the brightest stars in that particular constellation, the brightest and second brightest. And in general, stars in order of brightness were named after those Greek letters. The amazing thing is that they are part of the constellation of Centaurus, which looks nothing like a centaur at all. You know, you have to use so much imagination to even begin to see the shape of a half-man, half-horse character wrapped around the Southern Cross. So the Southern Cross is one of the recognisable ones. So is Orion, and so is Scorpius the Scorpion. So finally, if you look way down below and to the left of the Cross and the Pointers into our southeastern sky, there's the Scorpion, a really large constellation, long line of stars curling around to the stinger in the end of his tail. You can't miss him, and watch out for its brightest star called Antares. It's a red giant star, and that colour is really easy to pick out. So plenty of stargazing to be done at this time of the year, and the Milky Way is going to get even better as we move through winter and into early spring.
I just like the way the imagination of seeing those shapes, because my wife and I, we study the clouds a lot and see all different shapes in these clouds, you know, like a dog or something. Yeah. It's just as much imagination used to do that, I suppose.
Well, yes, you need imagination. The constellations are a big join the dots game, of course, but people from different parts of the world have seen different patterns in the stars too, because of their different languages, their different culture, their different history. There are 88 standard constellations that we see on our star charts, but going around the world, a lot more have been thought up, and it's really fascinating to think about those different cultures. For example, in Thailand, Orion, which we see as an upside down man, is considered to be, would you believe, a turtle with a plough on its back. That's an unusual combination to begin with. But I can't see that pattern at all. But yeah, it's quite well known in Thailand.
Oh, seeing things from a different perspective.
Well, absolutely, yes. And there's fascinating insight into their history. I've done some studies of the star patterns that were thought up by the Mizo people from Mizoram in far northeastern India. And they've got a huge variety of different ideas about the stars based on things that happen in their everyday lives and so on. And I've even co-authored a book on it. So that was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you very much for your time this morning. It's been a pleasure as usual. I've learned something, and no doubt the listeners have learned something, and a lot. And if they want to be involved in seeing some of the things at the planetarium and the Hive, it's a good time to drop in and see it.
Yes, we have regular programs all listed on our website. So go and take a look at the Hive website, and you'll find not just the planetarium information, but all the other things that are exciting here at Hive too. So there's plenty to do here.
Well, thank you, Dr. Martin George. As usual, this is a regular thing. We're going to try and keep it going throughout the year and see how we go, and keep an eye on what's up there.
I'll look forward to that, Brian. Speak to you again soon. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.